Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mehler here. We are spending our show with Mike Riley. He is going to, he's a Madison lawyer, and he's going to tell us more about choosing a lawyer and cover what to do if you get a traffic ticket. We can talk about insurance with him. Mike's practice is focused on obtaining a fair compensation for people who suffer injuries due to others' negligence. He also represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation, and arbitration. So, questions about a home or auto insurance, what are your legal questions? Join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Mike Riley, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Larry. It's always a pleasure. Look forward to hearing from your listeners.
Tell you what, let's talk about, start just by talking about picking a lawyer. And maybe, I mean, there are obvious reasons for getting a lawyer, but overall, what circumstances require a lawyer?
Well, I think there are a number of things that you can do on your own, and people call into the show and people call me at the office and ask about things. And one of the first things I say is, have you spoken to these people on the other side? You know, have you tried to reach a solution? And it's kind of surprising. I remember one of my early landmark cases, a gal came in to me with a failed tattoo. And she was quite concerned. And I looked at the tattoo and I couldn't imagine, you know, that it would have been anything great, even if it had been performed perfectly. But I said, so, you know, have you talked to the tattoo artist? And she said, no. And I said, well, you know, why don't you give him a call? And she did. And he said, I can fix that. And apparently did. And she called me back about a week later and said, hey, it's great. Thanks. Now, that's trivial, obviously. But, you know, often I think people get understandably upset because they have a dispute and the other side isn't reacting in a way that they see as fair. And sometimes, you know, you need a lawyer. And certainly when you have significant things at stake, I mean, if it's a significant amount of money, if you're buying a home, you know, if you're looking at something where you're being asked to sign a contract that might obligate you to spend a lot of money at some point or to do something that you may not want to do, I think those are situations where you should certainly at least consider hiring a lawyer. You know, what I do obviously involves people who've been injured in accidents. And in those cases, you know, I think it is very important to speak with a lawyer. In those cases specifically, any lawyer, well, certainly you should ask, but any lawyer should and most will give you a free consultation so that it's not going to cost you anything to talk to a lawyer. And people will call me and say, do you think this is worth pursuing? And I, you know, I'll say, well, why don't we talk about it? You tell me about it and give me some detail, and then I can tell you whether I think you need a lawyer. But particularly in injury cases, what often happens is insurance companies are in business, you know, to make money. That's what they do. There's nothing evil about that. But, you know, their interest when there's a claim is not to make sure that the person gets the most money or even a fair amount of money. It's to try to settle the claim, protect their own insured, and protect themselves. And so they're going to try to settle claims early on in most cases because the companies know that the longer a claim goes on, the more likely it is they're going to have to pay a greater amount of money. And so it's not uncommon at all. In fact, it's probably you can expect that if you're injured in an accident, you're going to get a call from the company, and frequently they'll say, well, look, we'll pay you $500 or $1,500, and we'll pay your medical bills for 6 months. And, you know, people often think that they're going to get better, don't think an injury is terribly serious, and nobody really wants to deal with that. It's just another complication in your life that, you know, you'd rather do without. And so people get lured into that occasionally, and then they settle and they sign a release. And once you sign a release, that's pretty much all she wrote. It's awfully, awfully difficult to get out of it. So in those cases, I'd certainly recommend that you call a lawyer, can call more than one. We'll talk about that, because I think generally speaking, when you're going to hire a lawyer, you should meet with a lawyer. I think it's a good idea to meet with more than one lawyer rather than just jump at the first, you know, opportunity. Just, it's so important if you're involved in something, particularly an injury claim that's going to go on likely, if it's a long-term injury, you're going to be dealing with that lawyer for a couple of years, quite possibly. And maybe, although it's unlikely anymore, but maybe you'll end up in a courtroom. You need to have someone you're comfortable with that fits with you, you know, that listens to you and that responds to your questions and your concerns. And so I think I said I know that the worst way to choose a lawyer to me is one of these ads or going online and picking a lawyer. It's just not a sound way to choose a lawyer, and it's just not likely that you're going to get the right fit for you.
Yeah, it's interesting. You see so many TV ads, and even highway billboards may not be the best place to start.
They really aren't, and that's no, I'm not suggesting that everybody who advertises are not good lawyers. Some are, you know, some frankly are not all that great. But the bottom line is that the fact that people are willing to spend millions of dollars on ads is certainly no guarantee that they're the right lawyer for you or are going to do the best job for you. And in fact, there's at least some concern with that kind of thing where people pump really huge amounts of money into ads. You know, I think most lawyers would tell you that firms that do that, you know, may not spend as much time on each individual case and may be more motivated to settle cases quickly. Don't know that's going to be the case, but I think that it is not the best way to choose a lawyer. And there are so many, there are alternatives. I mean, if you know a lawyer, even one who doesn't do the kind of work you may need done, you know, he may be able to recommend somebody. If you have friends who, you know lawyers or have used lawyers, they may be able to give you a recommendation. Martindale Hubbell's the national rating organization for lawyers. AV is, you know, their top rating. BV is still very good. You know, they're worth looking at. Milwaukee Magazine, Madison Magazine do annual best lawyers things that certainly are a source, not the only source, but a source to look at because they involve peer ratings, as does Martindale Hubbell. So, you know, they at least give you an idea about what other lawyers think about a particular lawyer's abilities.
Yeah. A listener emailed, this is about picking, this is sort of a maybe not unusual case. They need a lawyer who knows California law regarding a tax issue, and they're in Wisconsin. So who do they get now? Do they ask in Wisconsin, or do they call somebody in California?
I think the first thing I do is call a lawyer in Wisconsin who specializes in tax matters. They often can reach out and get a recommendation. And I don't mean to come back to my topic all the time, but on personal injury matters, we have a state organization that the personal injury lawyers all belong to or mostly belong to. And I can go to that organization and get a recommendation from an organization in another state so that I can recommend a lawyer from that state or make a referral to a lawyer. And I think the same thing would be true with tax law. But I think I'd start with a local lawyer because, again, other than going to Martindale Hubbell or something like that, I'm not sure how you'd reach out to California. And again, I know everybody can go on the web and find lots of things, but I always find those things inherently suspect. You know, I think you're better off with a local lawyer and have him make a recommendation. I doubt that he would be able to handle the problem himself, assuming it's a state law problem, not a national or federal problem. But he certainly could reach out and get you a recommendation for somebody that should be able to help.
Chris in Cedarburg has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Chris. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call. 2 weeks ago, I was involved in an accident. A young man rear-ended me and totaled my car, totaled his car. It was 100% his fault. He admitted guilt to not paying attention. Now I'm fighting with his insurance company because they totaled my vehicle and they're trying to lowball the number. I was the original owner. I drove 99.9% of the miles on the car, had all the service records, and yet they're trying to give me like scrap value. They had one guy give me a lowball figure. I told them that was not acceptable. They elevated to the next person, and she is not very helpful either. 2 weeks running now, and I'm still chasing around with these people. They don't seem to understand that it was a perfectly good car and perfectly good health, and now I don't have it. So they say we don't base our insurance on replacement costs. I said, I don't care. I'm not an American Family customer or client. And you took my, your client took my car away from me.
Yeah, you know, first of all, Chris, this is a classic problem and a very frustrating one, and I hear this all the time. You know, it's a particular problem with older vehicles because you have a car, just as you said, you've driven it from the beginning, it's reliable, you know it. You're not going to be able to find that car. I mean, even if they would pay you replacement value, you're going to have to go out and buy something either from a dealer or an individual, and you're going to have no assurance you're getting what you had. And that's difficult. What the law says is that they have to put you back where you were. Now, they can't literally do that, but they have to buy you a comparable car or pay you what it's going to cost you to buy a comparable car. You know, whether you can get something truly comparable, that's a tough issue, and unfortunately the law doesn't do much with that. I'm assuming, I know you didn't mention an injury, so hopefully you weren't injured in the accident.
Young men were injured, so that's a plus.
That's great.
Yeah.
The last step I made was send them comparables because they gave me two lowball offers because I told them, you have to make me whole. And
that's
you're
right.
Not even in the ballpark in terms of a price that will. And I sent them. It did have high mileage. Again, all highway. I drove 99% of them. I said, but what you're offering, I can't even get close to buying a replacement of similar year/mileage. And they.
Oh. Okay. So, in that case, is it time for a lawyer, Mike?
Well. It may be. I guess the other question to Chris is, Chris, what kind of money are we talking about? What would it take to get you a vehicle that's at least comparable, even though it's obviously not what you had?
Well, I've told them from the get-go, and I did some research on the Internet because everyone's a genius with the Internet. But I said, I think a fair figure would be $7,500, and they're at $62, so we're quite a ways away. And I guess they feel like they don't have to make a Wisconsin resident whole, even though they're a Wisconsin-based company.
Yeah, and it's they're not alone. The companies have gotten far more difficult to deal with over the last 10 years. The difficulty with a case like this is obvious, and that is the amount of money we're talking about. The difference is $1,300. Normally, I'd suggest small claims, and you could look at that, but what happened was they changed the small claims law and raised the limit to 10,000. It had been lower. The problem is the insurance companies, you know, who have a lot of clout with the legislature, got them to limit it to 5,000 for insurance companies. Again, you could check that, but I'm virtually certain that's right. So that means that that really takes that remedy away because, you know, you're already over that. The problem with, you know, getting a lawyer is obvious. For any lawyer, nobody can take that on a percentage or contingency because you're talking about, you know, a third of, what, $1,200. And, you know, it's difficult. I mean, you could file a lawsuit, pro se, that is on your own. You don't technically need a lawyer to do that. Would the insurance company respond to that by raising the ante a little? They might. But, you know, this is just, it's a knotty problem. Again, I hear it all the time, and I know how frustrating it is. You know, I'd continue to push them and see if you can get them to at least come up to a number that's closer. I mean, one of the things that is kind of traditional in the industry, whether it's a lawyer dealing with them or someone else, is sometimes you get to a point where you can just say, okay, look, let's split the difference and I'll call it quits. And maybe, you know, they might be willing to do that. I wish I had a better answer for you, Chris, but it's a knotty problem and it comes up all the time. And again, the solution should be to go to small claims court, but because of the limits, I'm not sure you're going to be able to do that with an insurance company.
There you go, Chris. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Mike Riley, our guest today, a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm. Trina LaSousa, our engineer, and Clara Neipert, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at insurance today with our guest, Mike Riley, a Madison attorney with the Axley Law Firm. He's a senior partner in the firm. Great to have him with us. Questions for him. I know we want to talk about insurance, and I know we want to talk about things relating to selecting a lawyer, but I'm sure Mike's more than happy to take your questions at 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Martin in Milwaukee has a question for you, Mike. Let's go there. Martin, hi.
Yes. I had a similar situation as the last caller where it was a car accident. I was involved in one on Easter, and the way this accident happened was a guy ran a red light and totaled out my car. And so... you know, I did some homework, and turns out at the intersection where it happened, there was a car dealer that actually had a video that showed, you know, that I had the right of way at the intersection where the light was. And, you know, I was, and I also had a witness, you know, somebody stopped that perfectly, you know, said that, the guy, you know, went through the light and everything. And, you know, my airbags went off and everything, but I had a little bit of an injury, but I didn't even realize it right away. But I didn't claim any injury, but so I was trying to deal with the insurance company on my own. But it seemed like they were just dragging their feet, you know. They wouldn't respond back. And when they did, you know, they would claim I was – 20% at fault, you know. But what, you know, I had all this evidence of, you know, from the video and from the, I had witnesses and everything. And I was just wondering, like, without an injury, are there attorneys that take a case like that, or do you have to deal on your own with that?
No, I think that attorneys will take the case. And first of all, it's a great question because these are things that happen all the time. I mean, there's no question in that case that you have no fault. And companies have this wonderful theory, not all, but a lot of the companies say, well, you're 10% at fault for just being on the road. That's ridiculous. No, you're not. When somebody runs a red light, that is 100% their fault. Can somebody argue, well, you should, maybe, but that's going nowhere. The fact is that's clearly entirely the fault of their insured, not your fault at all. And companies have formulas. They look at things, you know, everything is something that they've seen before, think they've seen before. And, you know, they do, if you're at an open intersection and, you know, you have the right of way, if you're on the right, you have the right of way. They'll look at that and say, well, maybe you're 25% at fault anyway because you could have been more careful. But when you're coming off a stop sign or you're particularly running a red light, that's your responsibility. You have every right as a driver to assume that somebody is going to obey the law and stop at a red light. You don't have to, you know, slow your vehicle as you approach a green light because somebody might be going to run the red, although heaven knows it happens these days more often than it should. But that's completely their fault. I just say, okay, explain to me why you think I'm 20% at fault, because that's not what the law says at all. Secondly, in terms of the value, and again, that's where we get back to the problem we had with Chris, is when you talk about value, a lot depends on how much your car costs. We just handled a case for a professor at the U who had a Porsche that was an expensive car. And that was certainly worth handling, and we did. We did it on an hourly basis because we didn't feel like taking a percentage would be fair in that case. And we were able to get him what we thought was a very fair settlement in the end. Nobody wants to be in an accident. Nobody ever quotes gets made whole from my standpoint, because I look at it and say, okay, would anybody take the amount of money I'm going to get them to go through this? And the answer is no. No one would. You'd rather it didn't happen, but it has. So, again, the question here is really, you did have an injury, and you apparently you didn't pursue that. Certainly a lawyer would help you with that. And the other point you made that I think is really important for people to understand is it's very common to be in an accident and not initially believe you're injured. You know, your adrenaline's pumping, you know, you're shocked and surprised that it happened. And in a lot of cases, people don't realize they're injured till hours or even a few days later. So that's not an uncommon experience at all. But, you know, the injury would be an easier thing to get a lawyer involved in generally because of the money involved. Well, the loss to the vehicle, and again, depending on what kind of car it is, might be enough to justify it. And often when you do get a lawyer and the lawyer writes the company, some companies will have the same adjuster handle the claim. Many companies will bump it to a different adjuster, and that adjuster may take a little different view. The first adjusters, frankly, to me, are not as well trained as they used to be. They're very reliant on computers. And, you know, if you're an adjuster, your boss very seldom gets upset that you didn't offer enough money. If you offer too much money, your boss gets very upset. So you know which way an adjuster is going to be inclined to go, at least at the beginning.
There you go, Martin. Thank you so much for calling. Let's take a call from Mike in Madison next. Mike, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry and Mike. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. Hey, I joined the conversation late, but I wanted to let you guys know that the State Bar of Wisconsin offers a lawyer referral and information service where their legal referral specialist can refer individuals who are in a legal problem. And it doesn't matter where you live, wherever you are in the state. They can match you with the lawyer who's best suited for your case. And individuals can submit a request online, or they can call 888-640-3874 between 8 and 5 Monday through Friday.
So I thought that
was just an important point to make.
Yeah. Mike, a comment? Mike Riley?
Sure. Thanks, Mike, for calling. Another Mike with great ideas. You know, what can we say? No, that is a good suggestion, Mike. If the lawyer referral and information service at the state bar, I think one, and it is a place where sometimes people can go when they're having difficulty finding a lawyer, and it's certainly worth considering. Not every lawyer will accept referrals, and, you know, it's so you have to make sure, again, that you're getting the right person for you. I'd certainly, if you're going to do that, call, meet with the lawyer. And again, if it seems like a good fit, great. A good way, certainly a good way to go. I think it isn't the only source, and maybe not the best source in some cases, but it certainly is a good source. It's an important resource, and I appreciate Mike mentioning it.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Marsha in Madison has a question. Marsha, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted some information on umbrella insurance. At one time, I owned rental property, so I carried it. And now I'm in my mid-80s and living in a condo, but I've inherited some money, and substantial. And I just don't know the feasibility of umbrella insurance or not. Could you speak to that?
Sure. First, what is umbrella insurance?
The umbrella policy is a policy that you carry over and above your basic insurance. So your basic auto insurance, your basic homeowner's insurance, has a certain limit, and we'll probably talk about that as time goes on. But the umbrella policy is there to cover over the limits. And companies that issue umbrellas require that you have a certain amount of coverage on your basic policy, so your basic auto policy, your basic homeowners. But the umbrella coverage over and above that is really relatively inexpensive. And certainly anybody who has significant assets should have an umbrella policy. The biggest risk you have, obviously, is operating your vehicle. I mean, that's where your exposure comes. In this day and age, with medical bills soaring, it's awfully easy to have a claim that can go over $100,000 or even much more than that. And obviously, if somebody suffers a catastrophic injury, which happens, they're not common and they're awful things. But when they do happen, I mean, we settled a case last year for $3.5 million in an auto case, and lawyers settle cases for over $1 million fairly regularly these days. And so having a policy, even if you have the minimum limits are 25-50, which nobody should have in my view, but even 100-300, which is probably the most common policy. When I say 100-300, it's or 25-50, the first number is the limit for a single person that's injured in an accident. the larger limit is the limit for all persons. So if there's four people in the car and they're all injured, the maximum coverage you have is $300,000. And again, it just, to me, anybody with significant assets should have the umbrella policy. You can explore that, you know, with an agent for a specific company, or, you know, an agent who writes for a number of companies, an independent agent, and, you know, they can advise you on what you need and how much it will cost. But insurance base, the basic cost of insurance is built into the very first thing you buy. So if you buy a minimum limits policy, you know, increasing that from 2550 to 100, 300 does not cost nearly as much as you think. It doesn't go up by, you know, a factor of you know, 4 or 10 or anything like that. And it's even more true with the umbrella, because you've got a basic policy, and companies know that the vast majority of claims, vast majority, are going to fall within those basic limits. So what they're insuring is the rare claim that's going to actually go beyond those limits, which makes an umbrella policy a good deal and really is something that anyone who's got significant assets should have.
Marcia, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. David in Janesville, we'll give you a chance. Hi, David.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. A lady friend of mine is going through an awful breakup, and she was driving a third party's car and had an accident with it. Her ex-boyfriend had her on an insurance policy, but she has no information at all. She was never carrying around in her wallet an insurance card. She doesn't know which insurance company she was under. How can she find this out short of a lawsuit?
Well, because the boyfriend doesn't want to give her the information?
Correct.
Okay.
Boy, the pettiness of humanity shows really to horrible ill advantage when you have those kinds of situations. I see so much of it, and I can never believe it, but it's very real, unfortunately. So, first of all, if you're driving somebody else's vehicle, their insurance is primary. So the insurance coverage on that vehicle is the very first coverage. And unless the claim goes beyond the coverage that's provided under the policy of the vehicle you're driving, you don't have to worry about your own policy or what policy you might have. Does she own a vehicle?
She does not. She owned a vehicle jointly with this ex-boyfriend. As a matter of fact, they both still own it because it's taking a lawyer to divide up their property.
Well, the first thing is, since you need a lawyer to divide the property, the lawyer should go to the other lawyer, because anytime you're trying to deal with these people like this person evidently is directly, that's just a difficult situation. And you shouldn't have to file a lawsuit. If they're involved in legal action to divide their property, then the lawyer who's representing her in that action should simply go to the lawyer who represents the other person and say, we need this information. And if they won't give it, if there's already a legal action there, a court will compel it, I'm sure. You know, she can just have the lawyer go to court and say, hey, we need this information. But the first thing I do is check on the coverage for the vehicle she's driving, because that's the primary coverage, the first coverage that the other side would go to.
There you go, David. Thank you. Samantha in Arcadia called, couldn't stay with us. She has a brother and sister-in-law going through a divorce. Should they have one lawyer or two?
One. No, two. Very few lawyers will represent two parties in a divorce. I'm not even sure it's ethical. You can maybe argue it is, and I'm not condemning a lawyer if they do that, because I don't know the rules that specifically with divorce. But generally speaking, you can't represent two parties where there's a potential conflict, even though they say, well, we're going to agree on this. Now, because you have two lawyers doesn't mean you have to have a big battle. You shouldn't. If you want to hire two lawyers, each side should instruct their lawyer, look, here's what we want. We want this to be done. But the other thing that's important, Larry, is this, is that when you're in that situation, you know, it's a very emotional situation. It's a difficult situation. No one's happy. Everyone would like it over. And sometimes you can get taken advantage of. And you need a lawyer to say to you, look, this is what your rights are. Now, if you don't want to fight over certain things, that's your call as the client. But the lawyer should tell you what your rights are and what you are entitled to. And then, again, if you want to agree, fine. But I think generally, my guess is you'd find very, very few divorce lawyers who would, one, be willing to do it, and certainly who would advise you that that's an okay thing to do. I don't think it is.
Let's take a call from Sean in Westfield. Sean, hi.
Hey, guys. Very good to talk to you. So my wife and I just started a small self-serve nursery off the side of our property. And we don't really bring in a ton of cash or anything like that. But I'm kind of concerned about any liability we may have if someone were to, like, trip, like, in the little parking area, or, like, cut themselves on, like, the chicken wire fence or something like that. Any ideas?
Sure. First of all, and this isn't to discourage you, because I'm going to tell you, you probably should check on insurance. But I will say, I think, you know, I've served on boards for a bunch of different things. And in particular, I coached everything under the sun. So I served on a lot of boards for, you know, athletic programs. People's perception of what the risk is tends to be much more dramatic than the real risk. One, you know, you mentioned the chicken wire thing. The chance that anyone would make a claim or try to sue you because they cut themselves on chicken wire is really, really small. People don't do that as a rule, and lawyers don't take those cases because they're not worth very much money, if anything. You know, trip and falls are another matter. Again, just because somebody trips and falls on your property doesn't mean that you're legally liable. Often you're not. I mean, if somebody just misplaces their footing and falls, that's not your fault. They'd have to show that you were negligent, that there you created an unreasonable risk of injury because of the way the property was maintained or something you placed on the property. So, you know, I don't think the risk is great. That said, I'd certainly talk to an agent, maybe an independent agent, maybe an agent for one of the larger companies. But I'd talk to somebody and just see what they have to say. What's it going to cost you? And, you know, if the cost is relatively small, then just the peace of mind is probably worth it. But that's, you know, that's what I do. I think that you're something that I'd spend a lot of time worrying about? No. Would it be nicer to spend no time worrying about it because, you know, you have insurance? Yes. And probably if it's a business, it's likely your homeowner's policy doesn't cover it. There's always exclusions in most policies about running a business or something that's connected with a business in a personal homeowner's policy. So check with an agent, see what it would cost, and then just decide whether it's worth that to you.
Mary in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I am 91 years old. I saw an ophthalmologist in April of last year because I had been told I needed to have cataract surgery on both eyes. And on this ophthalmologist and I agreed that because I have been an avid reader all my life, it would be best for me to have a reading lens put in my eyes and then wear glasses as reading for distance. But on that initial visit, I started adding up all my hobbies, which are many, and I came to the conclusion that would not be the best thing. So I talked at great lengths to the surgery scheduler to remind her that I needed to have another appointment with the doctor to bring him up to complete knowledge of how I use my eyes. And on three occasions, she told me the doctor knows everything he needs to know about your eyes because of all the testing you've had done, and we don't give additional in appointments. And I kept telling her, yes, he knows about my eyes, but he's not knowing the full extent of how I use my eyes with all my multiple hobbies. But so she and I agreed that I could have a distance lens, which would be the opposite, of course, of what the original opinion was. Well, now I had this surgery last July. I have no correction in my eyes at all, and I have been adjudged to be legally blind. It is very difficult for me to do anything. I haven't been able to read for over a year. I can't sort my laundry. I can't sort out all the books I want to donate to the library. I am not able to really keep track of insurance policies of any kind or CD rates. I am totally helpless, and I'm wondering if at this time I need.
Yeah, I faded out a little there.
Yeah, I think she's wondering if she needs to see a lawyer, and
I think so too, Larry. I think the answer is yes. And I'll give my brief primer on medical malpractice because I get those questions quite frequently. Medical malpractice claims are difficult. They're expensive because they're expert intensive. A lawyer has to go out and hire an expert just to evaluate the claim, and then, you know, ultimately is going to need an expert to testify as the case goes forward. Because of that, because they're expensive, and also because, frankly, they tend to be very hard fought. Doctors don't readily concede liability. In fact, it's a rarity when they do concede liability, and which is unlike most other claims that lawyers handle. A liability is not a major issue in the vast majority of claims I handle. It is in medical malpractice, and you get two things. You get one, they say, well, you know, the procedure was done properly, and the fact that it came out that way is just a risk of the procedure. That's a known risk, and you can't, you know, and likely she was given some literature that suggested that. Part of the problem here is that these days, particularly, doctors do not take a lot of time to listen. I hear that from my clients all the time. And it's true, unfortunately, and that's part of the problem that leads to this. And why they wouldn't give her another appointment doesn't make any sense. Testing doesn't tell you how she uses her eyes or how disastrous it would be for her if she had a certain result. And it sounds to me like they should have done a much better job. And that's really at least partially an informed consent issue. Informed consent just says you should know the risks of the procedure, and they should have been carefully explained to you before you undertake a surgery. And it sounds like that may not have happened here. The bottom line is there are people certainly in the Milwaukee area and throughout the state who do medical malpractice. It's not every lawyer or every lawyer who handles personal injury claims, again, because they are difficult. They're very specialized. The guy who I've dealt with over the years in Milwaukee is a guy named Mike End. He's a great guy, very fine lawyer. Mike's focused his practice on medical malpractice for years. I believe he's likely still practicing. He's certainly somebody I would recommend. The Habish firm in Milwaukee, they also have offices in Madison and elsewhere. They're a very fine law firm, and certainly you could talk to somebody from that firm. It's Habish and Rotier. And there are other firms as well, but those are people that I know are very good, and it would be worth consulting. Again, I'm sure they'd be happy to talk to you. Whether they'll take the case or not is another issue. They are difficult, and lawyers expect there to be very substantial damages. And, you know, what's happened to her is certainly a tremendous impact on her life. Whether that's enough, you know, I guess that would be up to the lawyer she speaks with. And again, the lawyer's going to have to evaluate the liability situation, see what the records say, and make a decision as to whether or not it's a claim that can be pursued successfully. So I always tell people, I think you have to start down that path knowing that there's a good chance that it's not a claim you can pursue, but it's certainly worth at least talking to someone.
Yeah. Mary, good luck. I'm sorry for your situation, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Talking with Mike Riley, Madison, a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm, about all kinds of things. We've gotten into insurance, for sure. We've gotten into picking a lawyer. We're going to talk about original intent as well. That's something that's been in the news recently. And I hope you'll stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at legal issues today with our guest, Mike Riley. Mike, a Madison attorney, a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm. His practice focuses on obtaining fair compensation for people who suffer injuries due to others' negligence, and he also represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation, and arbitration. So you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Mike, people probably have heard about the Supreme Court and the doctrine of original intent. It was recently in the news. Maybe the first question is, what is original intent, and how do you view the theory?
Well, I'm not a friend of the theory, but the theory is that what we should do when we're interpreting the law and the Constitution specifically is to look to the intent of the framers of the Constitution. So they're saying, okay, well, we'll just go back and look at what the framers wanted us to do with the Constitution, how they wanted the Constitution to be viewed, and therefore, you know, that'll tell us how we ought to decide questions of constitutional law. And, you know, the theories with that are multiple. Problems with that theory, I should say, are multiple. First of all, you know, there were a bunch of framers, and, you know, they weren't one or two people. I mean, look at Jefferson, who did a lot of the, drafting, and Adams, who was very prominent. But the fact is, there were a whole bunch of different people involved in framing the Constitution and obviously approving the Constitution. And, you know, some of them were very bright people. Some of them were gifted and highly principled. Many of them were not. I mean, its politics weren't that different back then than they are now. There are some wonderful people doing that and some people that none of us think are all that wonderful. People on each side view what wonderful is very differently. So, you know, you have to say, okay, which framer are you talking about? Because there are a whole bunch of them. And, you know, are they really people who we think were preternaturally gifted, so we should just do whatever it is we think they wanted us to do? And I think that's a major problem. Second, you know, I think people are well aware that the Constitution involved all sorts of compromises. And, you know, the North and South back then didn't agree very much, then fought a civil war, and now don't agree on a lot of things again. And so, you know, there were compromises to get the states to approve the Constitution, and some of those involved slavery, some of them involved a lot of other things. So it wasn't a document that was, you know, designed or intended to be viewed as if it were handed down in stone from the Mount. It was a document that, very much like laws today, involved compromises, involved things that some of the framers, I'm sure, felt were totally inappropriate on both sides. And again, to say, okay, just let's look at what they intended. Well, did they really intend the compromises to be ideal things, the laws that they really would say we want interpreted literally? I doubt it. And also, you know, they provided for an amendment. And I guess you can say, well, but that's only amendments. Well, clearly they didn't view it as a doctrine that was to be unchanging. That's not the way they viewed it. And then finally, you know, the framers certainly collectively were a bright group of people, you know, not gifted beyond the ken of modern man, but got gifted people. So you know, we really believe that they would have wanted us to interpret a constitution in the 21st century that was adopted in the 18th, and we believe that it should be the way it was back then, you know, 250 years ago. Is that really what they would have intended? Certainly if we view them as gifted, intelligent people, it's not the way they would have viewed it. So I've never really understood how people who I think probably are intelligent can put forth that theory and say that's the way we should view the Constitution. I think if we do that, we're straitjacketing ourselves, you know, in views from the 18th century, which really have very little validity at all today. I mean, if you look, the simplest thing, if you look at the Constitution, the approach they took to slavery, my heavens, nobody ever would believe that today or believe it was appropriate or believe that that's the way we should look at things. So I don't think the theory holds water. I never have. You know, it's gotten, I guess, politicized to accept, but I don't think it's a political question at all. I think it's a question of looking at how the Constitution was drawn, who drew the Constitution, and saying, okay, that we'll interpret the Constitution in a way that makes sense now. So if you're really looking at, if you want to say, what did the framers think, you should have to say not what did they think then, but what would they think if they were drafting a constitution now?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my two cents.
Okay. Well, so more of is essentially considering it a living document.
That's exactly right, Larry. I think that's a perfect way to capture it. It's a living document. It wasn't, you know, intended to be, you know, left exactly the way it was. It just never was. And you, if for any law isn't unchanging. Society isn't unchanging. And law needs to reflect the changes in society.
Let's take another call. Mark in Milwaukee will give you a chance. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Yeah, I was injured a couple years ago in one of the big box home improvement stores. I was getting some 4x4 inch by 8 foot long green treated timbers or fence posts. They were in a tall stack, and I was getting them by myself and trying to, you know, get a, find some non-twisted ones. And the stack fell over and whacked me in the knee, and I, you know, they saw me and went and got the manager, and he said, "You want to get an ambulance?" I'm like, "Well, I'm all right, I'm fine." And, well, I never really recovered. I mean, the knee periodically gives me trouble if I kneel or walk too much. They blew me off thereafter. Interestingly enough, they did put a sign up with a pull cord even to alert right there by those heavy timbers. Should you need help, pull this and it will summon somebody. So, but they didn't want to actually do anything. I called here, nobody was willing to take anything. Any other recourse?
Well, you know, I'm a little surprised lawyers wouldn't take it. Is it, you know, a court case where you'd say, well, clearly they're at fault? I don't think it's clear, but do I think that there's a good argument that they're at fault? Yeah. I mean, that sounds like the way they stacked those was dangerous. It created an unnecessary risk, which is generally the definition of negligence. And, you know, you fell into the trap that they set, in effect. And the fact that they corrected it afterwards is interesting. The law says that you can't use a subsequent remedial measure as evidence of negligence. And, you know, the theory in the law is we want people to fix things. And if we say, well, if you fix them, then we're going to hold that against you. You know, that creates a disincentive to repair things or fix a dangerous condition. But the law also says that it can be evidence of what you could have done to make it safe. So I don't think juries draw a big distinction between those things. You know, some of it's a matter of, you know, how much medical expense you have and, you know, how significant the knee injury is. Because, again, one of the things lawyers who do personal injury work do is they evaluate the case. Lawyers doing that work are almost always paid on a contingency fee basis, percentage of what they recover for you. And so, you know, if there's just not a whole lot there, then it makes it difficult for a lawyer to believe that, you know, they can, one, that they can get paid a reasonable amount of money, and two, that they can produce a result for you that's going to be enough to make it worth jumping through the hoops. But, you know, again, you could call lawyer referral and information service that somebody mentioned earlier. I don't know how many lawyers you spoke to or who you spoke to, but, you know, you could certainly try someone else, try another firm and see if they might be interested. Everybody takes a little different approach to things. And frankly, at least in my view, some of the firms that do a lot of the advertising, you know, are not real fond of things that are more difficult. There are other firms that might be a little more interested in taking on a challenge. So, you know, those are things to think about. But I think that there's a valid basis for a claim? I do. Would I say that's a lay down and that, you know, that you'll win automatically? No, I don't think that's true. But I think it certainly would be worth checking further to see if you can find somebody to pursue it for you.
Yeah. Is there a statute of limitation on an injury claim, by the way?
There is, Larry, and I'm glad you mentioned it. I should have mentioned it. It's 3 years generally from the date of the injury. You have to either settle the claim or start a lawsuit, file a lawsuit, and then serve the other side within those 3 years. So, and there are statute of limitations on a lot of different things, but injury is generally 3 years, and it's important, you know, bear that in mind.
Let's take a call from Jill in Racine. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Larry. I wanted to make a comment about my experience with attorneys. I received a quit claim deed, and it was in Arizona. And I called a handful of lawyers and got the same answer, can't do it, I'm in Wisconsin. And then I figured to myself, well, quitclaim deeds are pretty much the same in every state. I know there's particulars in every state and circumstances and all those kinds of things. And then I decided to call Wisconsin Referral. I did pay a fee, and this was 2 years ago. And I went ahead without a lawyer. And I thought, well, that's okay. There was another person who got served as well, and my former brother-in-law. And there was a court hearing over the phone, and a judge, and I couldn't win.
Mm.
So I more or less gave up, and it did involve my father's home in Arizona, and I gave up. And come to find out, my father's, it gets complicated. Maybe I'll spare the details.
You better, because we're just about out of time here before we have to break.
The home, a quitclaim deed says there's something not right with the deed. That's why I had to sign, and I refused to sign, and I wound up signing, but the other person did not sign. The person who filed the claim moved in the home.
Oh, well, here we are coming up. That's something for you to ponder on, Mike. Mike Riley, our guest today, a Madison attorney with the Axley Law Firm, and he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. So we'll take a look now at the news and then come back, and hopefully we'll have some comments for Mike about our previous caller. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at legal issues on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Michael Riley. Mike is a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. His practice focuses on getting fair compensation for people who suffer injuries due to others' negligence. And he also represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation, and arbitration. Questions, call us at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Mike, when we broke for news, we had Mary from Milwaukee, I believe, with an out-of-state quick claim deed issue. Sounds like she signed, but the other person involved in it didn't sign.
Let me start by saying I'm married to a Mary from Milwaukee who's the light of my life. So, you know, if I could be of help, I'd love to. But this one is, first of all, it's out of state, which makes it difficult. Secondly, it's real estate, which is certainly not my specialty. It never has been. And, you know, I will say this, a couple things. One, anytime you're dealing with a quitclaim deed, it's a concern, because when you get a warranty deed, then the person who's giving you the warranty deed is warranting that they have free and clear title. There's usually there's a title search. There's title insurance that guarantees, title insurance is probably what's commonly used these days, to ensure that you're getting what you think you're getting, which is, you know, the deed to that property. Quitclaim deeds simply say that the person who's giving you the deed is transferring whatever interest they have in that property, but they're not guaranteeing that that interest is free and clear and that they have the right to transfer the property. You know, if you did it fraudulently, that might create issues for the person that's transferring. But basically, you're not getting a guarantee that you really are getting the full property. I don't know which end of that she was on. That wasn't clear. I'm assuming she was transferring the property based on what she said, but I'm not sure that's true. You know, you would need to get somebody in Arizona. I mean, you could talk to a local lawyer, but again, I think a local lawyer would want you to deal with ultimately with a lawyer in Arizona to see, you know, what could be done. And honestly, without a lot more facts and a lot more expertise in that area, you know, I'm just not well equipped to answer that. One quick point I'd like to make, Larry. Somebody, Mike called in earlier from Madison and mentioned Lawyer Referral and Information Service. And, you know, I think it is a worthwhile service. I think it's something, you know, to consider. I do think of it a bit as more like a court of last resort because, you know, in my experience, you know, the people who sign up for Lawyer Referral and Information Service, and it's not something that all lawyers accept or that all lawyers are part of. It's really people who agree to sign up and take referrals. And in my experience, at least, it tends to be younger lawyers perhaps with, you know, who don't have a real full caseload, because I think other lawyers are, you know, less likely to take cases from that source. It doesn't mean you shouldn't think about using it at all. It's certainly worth considering, but I think that's, I guess I'd sound a little cautionary note about it.
We have Nancy calling, wondering, she had a minor office procedure and it took her 6 months and multiple other docs to get better. She's low income, wondering how to get, and the main question here, how do I get a lawyer pro bono? She has no money.
Well, it isn't so much pro bono in that case, because what you're really looking for is somebody who'd handle a medical malpractice claim, and that those claims are handled on a contingency fee basis. There are some of the larger firms do pro bono work. You know, it's harder to find an individual lawyer. Again, you could check with the state bar. They may have a list. I'm honestly not sure that's true, but it'd certainly be worth calling to see if there's a list of lawyers who are willing to consider pro bono work. Again, some very big firms do that as just part of service to the community, which is a praiseworthy thing to do. But I talked to, you know, I mentioned earlier, I think you mentioned Mike End, I mentioned the Hobbish firm. It's worth checking if it's going to be a med mal case. It would be done on a contingency or percentage of the recovery. And so you wouldn't have to worry about money. Now, some firms might require you to pay some costs, which you likely wouldn't be in a position to do. Again, the difficulty with most med mal cases, Larry, is they, for a firm to take them, the damages have to be very substantial. And what she's talking about, and I'm not minimizing the impact on her life at all, because those are terrible things to have to go through, but the chances that the damages would be enough to get somebody to look at that case, do it on a percentage basis, really are pretty small. And I don't know that it's the kind of thing that you'd, most firms that are even willing to do pro bono would do. I mean, it's possible. It's certainly worth checking. But, you know, I'm skeptical that you're going to find somebody to handle that on a either contingency fee or pro bono basis.
Let's take another call.
Let me make one real brief point about that. And for the earlier caller, too. You know, it doesn't get you compensated financially, and so that doesn't help. But if you feel that the doctor has not treated you appropriately, you can file a complaint with the medical examining board of the state. That at least, if you know, will give you the satisfaction of knowing somebody will look at it. And if the doctor has fallen below standards, hasn't done something the way he should have done it, there's a reasonable chance that the doctor could be disciplined. Doctors really don't like those complaints at all, I can tell you. So just having one filed is something they don't like. I'm certainly not encouraging people to run out and file complaints every time they're unhappy with their doctor, but if you really feel that the doctor has done something inappropriate, then it's worth considering filing a complaint with the medical examining board.
Rose in Menominee Falls will give you a chance now. Hi, Rose.
Hi there. I'm just calling. My grandson was in a car accident several years ago. He was driving his girlfriend's car. It was with her permission. She was in the car. They sideswiped another car. And, of course, the insurance company for that damaged car came after my grandson. The odd thing was there was never a police citation given, even though a police officer came to the scene. And in the subsequent years after, it went to a collection agency. The girlfriend would not give my grandson their insurance information. We came to find out later she was not insured, et cetera. So it got really muddy. But my main question is, over the course of these years, my grandson was living with me, and every time the collection person would call him or he would talk to her, I had him absolutely write down the date, the time, and what was said. And over the course of these years, it got very nasty. Even though my grandson admitted part of the, you know, that he would be partly to blame and offered to pay on a payment plan, the collection person would not accept that. She kept saying, no, 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 we want the full amount. You can ask your family, and on and on and on. In the end, she demanded, even though my grandson offered her more than what he should have even, she would not accept it. So at that point, I had my grandson write a letter to the insurance company that was after this and tell them all this communication, what he had offered to pay and how this collection person had not given it at all and wouldn't accept it, and that therefore the insurance company seemed to be getting a bad deal because they could have recouped some money. In the end, they recouped nothing.
Yeah, that's really a shame. And you know, like everything else in the world, there are people who do that work that are reputable and, you know, do the things the right way. It's not a lot of fun to do that work, I don't think. I know a few lawyers who do it, and I don't think it's anybody's favorite thing. But that's completely irresponsible. It may violate the Fair Debt Collections Act, which provides what they can do and can't do. And, you know, she may have violated that. Now, it sounds like they've finally given up. But, you know, you might want to consider filing a complaint with the, you know, Consumer Protection Agency at the Department of Agriculture. I think he still handles those matters. And they might be willing to look into it because that is totally irresponsible. And I don't believe it's something any reputable debt collection agency would do. I think Larry certainly had some experience with, you know, consumer protection issues. And I don't know, Larry, is there anything else that you can think of?
No, I would definitely call their 800 number, Wisconsin Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. And they have a consumer protection hotline, which I can't think of the number off the top of my head. I say it a lot, but you can find it pretty easily if you just go online to their website. You can get you can file a written claim, or you can a written statement, or you can just talk to somebody on the phone about it. They do have people there all the time to answer consumer complaints for sure.
And the collection people have to be licensed, I believe. So, you know, and I don't know if you could also check with state licensing. They may have, you know, they may also have a complaint process if, in fact, these people have to be licensed, because that's disgusting. I mean, that shouldn't happen. It's completely unfair. It was an accident. It's unfortunate. But your son, he tried to do the responsible thing and was treated irresponsibly, and that shouldn't happen.
We Cy from Hudson wonders if you could talk about insurance for rental cars. What are you covered for, and what aren't you covered for? You know, if you and I'm not sure if he means taking their insurance. You know, when you go to rent the car, they usually ask you to sign or to pay a, you know, an extra insurance fee. But
right, and it's such an incredible ripoff. I once had an agent tell me, "Oh, it's really a good deal," and it'd be like paying, you know, about $2,000 a month for your auto insurance. You know, it's just ridiculous. You know, I think the things you have to look at. I will say, though, a cautionary tale. One of my partners years and years ago rented a Ryder rental or one of the rental trucks and didn't take the insurance. You know, the added collision insurance or whatever, and managed to run it into an overpass and kind of took the top off it. And I spent quite a lot of time sorting that out for him. So, you know, there can be problems. But, you know, first of all, you know, a lot of credit cards, you know, offer you insurance. They build that in if you rent the car with their credit card. They build in the insurance, and that certainly, you know, you should look at, decide if you've got a credit card that's going to do that. The biggest thing, I mean, your own liability insurance will take care of the liability part. So that's not really the key. The real key is damage to the vehicle. And, you know, again, if somebody else damages the vehicle, you're probably okay, because assuming they have insurance, they're covered. But if you damage the vehicle, that may or may not be covered. And again, that's something you should check with your own insurance company about, you know, check before you need to do it and find out what they'll cover. A lot of companies used to do it. I think some of the companies have cut back on that. So it's worth taking a look at when you decide which credit card you're going to use to rent the car. And, you know, beyond that, we talked a little bit earlier about, you know, with a business person, we're talking about peace of mind. Well, you know, even though the amount that they charge is unreasonable, completely unreasonable, you know, if you say, okay, it's still a few bucks and I'm going to feel better, well, then, you know, spend a few bucks and feel better. Your own, you know, like I said, your policy will take care of the liability issues, which are the biggest issues. But, you know, cars cost a lot of money these days. And, you know, if you do significant damage to a car, that could be a good bit. So you want to be sure that's covered either through your own company, which it probably will not be, or through, you know, the card company that you use to pay for the rental.
John in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry and Michael. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was out walking and I got struck by a car while crossing the street.
Oh.
I wasn't in the crosswalk, but I was like angling towards it. But I read that in Wisconsin, everything is based on a percentage of who's at fault. It could be like 40% on person walking and 60% on the driver or whatever. And I was just wondering if that's correct or if you could explain that to me. Thank you.
No, thanks. That's a great question. That's absolutely right. Wisconsin's a comparative negligence state. So back in the bad old days, it used to be if you were contributorily negligent, you were 25%, you didn't recover because, you know, you were negligent. Well, that never made any sense, and they changed that. So what you have now is if you can be up to 50% and you will still recover, but the amount you recover will be reduced by your percentage of negligence. So in the example he used, if he was 40 and the other driver was 60, he'd still recover his damages, but he would recover 60% of his damages, not the full amount. In terms of the negligence thing, you know, if you're in the crosswalk, then, you know, it's probably 100-0 or very, very close to it. I mean, you can't dart out in front of a car, but if you're crossing in a normal fashion in a crosswalk and you get hit, that's going to be 100% on the other side or very close to it. Being out of the crosswalk means you don't have that presumption that you're not negligent, but, you know, it still doesn't mean that you're more negligent than the other side, or even that you carry a high percentage of negligence. I mean, if you looked and this person comes around the corner at an unreasonable rate of speed, if the person's exceeding the speed limit to begin with, under Wisconsin law, generally speed forfeits right away. So even though he might have the right of way, he might lose it because of his speed. The biggest thing really is, you know, what are the circumstances? Because that ultimately is what the question would be. Did you see him and you thought you could beat him across? Well, that's a bigger problem. Did you start crossing? And again, he's speeding, and so he got there much quicker than you thought. That's a much bigger problem for the other side. So it's fact-driven, but ultimately he's correct that we're a comparative negligence state. The question isn't whether you're negligent at all. The question is, you know, who's more negligent? Or, in, like I said, 50, in the 50-50 split, you still recover. 51, you don't recover.
Jim in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good afternoon. Two general questions about wills. I'm a retired or close to retirement, late 60s, with two adult children. And question I always have is if I'm doing a will and it's going to be, you know, pretty straightforward, even division of assets amongst my two grown-up children. Is it advisable to actually see an attorney about that, or is it perfectly fine to do a, you know, one of those online types of wills, Zoom, whatever they are, or whatever they're called? And then the second part of the question, and just to, again in general terms, you know, when you're setting up a will, a fairly simple will with your children, what are the advantages or disadvantages to setting up a trust? And, you know, and under what circumstances should you consider setting up a trust for your will?
Those are great questions, and I am absolutely the wrong person to answer them, since what I know about wills is probably, if you've been looking at them, you may well know more about wills than I do. What I would say is this, is that, you know, I think it's worth seeing a lawyer. You're not going to spend a lot of time doing that. It's a pretty simple will. And the big thing is the question you raised, you know, is it worthwhile to do a trust? I know people who are doing trusts in situations. I always think of trusts as like these generation skipping things because of the tax consequences. And I doubt, generally speaking now, there aren't a lot of tax consequences in a situation where you're not leaving millions of dollars to someone. But I think it's well worth spending, you know, and it shouldn't be a great deal of money. It's well worth spending the time and a bit of money to make sure that you are doing the best thing, that if there are certain bequests you want to make, if there, you know, it's not that, can you do it with one of the online kits? Yeah, I'm sure you can. Do I think it's the right thing to do? I generally don't. I think, you know, you never quite know what questions to ask with those things. And I think if you see a lawyer, the lawyer can help you with what questions to ask and tell you to begin with, does it make sense to consider a trust? Would there be some benefits to that? So I think that's the way to go.
Keith in Bondiwell emailed us and wonders, how do you select a divorce lawyer? What factors are important?
Well, I think, again, we talked about, you know, there are publications that come out statewide, Milwaukee Magazine, and they give you different categories of lawyers. It's not just personal injury lawyers by any means. They look at a lot of different categories, including divorce lawyers. I think the same kinds of thing, if you know people who've been through a divorce, which, you know, is not unlikely these days, you know, talk to them, see were they happy, did they feel they were well served. And I think at the end of the day, the most important thing to me is talk to people, you know, talk to the lawyer, meet with a couple lawyers, make sure you have somebody that you're going to be comfortable with. You're going to be getting advice in any situation with a lawyer. You got to be comfortable relying on that advice. And in a divorce, I think that's more so than a lot of other things, because, again, there's so much emotion very often in divorce situations, and people's perception of what is fair and what they're entitled to can vary pretty dramatically. And finally, I did divorce early on, so unlike wills, I actually do know something about divorce. You don't want a lawyer that's going to pick fights you don't need to have. I've seen divorce lawyers run up bills that are truly unconscionable because they're going to fight about everything. And if there are fundamental things that you want to fight about, that you need to fight about, well, then, you know, you need a lawyer who can do that. But you also want a lawyer who isn't creating, you know, lawyers to me should solve problems. That's the most basic thing that you should be able to count on from your lawyer, is he's going to solve the problem to the extent that it can be solved. I think the last thing you want is a lawyer who creates problems, and they are out there. Believe me, I wish they weren't, but they are. So, you know, find somebody that you meet with. You talk to them about what you're expecting, what you want out of the divorce, what your goals are, and then find somebody who you're, when they tell you, look, here's what we can do, here's what we need to do, you're going to be willing to listen to that.
Mike, and on that note, I want to thank you so much for taking your time today to be with us. I always appreciate it, and I hope we can do this again down the road.
Well, thanks, Larry. It's always a pleasure. It's great to talk to you, and it's always wonderful to hear from your listeners.
Mike Riley, our guest. Michael Riley is a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. And great to have him with us. And, you know, he focuses on getting fair compensation for people who suffer injuries from others' negligence, and does a lot of work in the insurance coverage issues, mediation and arbitration as well. Great to have him here. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with some entomologists. They know that insects communicate by moving their wings and legs, and we listen in on bugs conversations tomorrow with expert P.J. Leash. That's tomorrow at 11. Stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.